In the old school they use now for the village hall hangs a small, dusty painting of a horse. He stands a splendid red bay, with a remarkable white cross emblazoned on his forehead, and with four perfectly matched white socks. He looks wistfully out of the picture, his ears pricked forward, his head turned, as if he has just noticed us standing there. To many who glance casually, it is merely a tarnished old oil painting of some unknown horse by a competent but anonymous artist. But those who look more closely will see in fading black copperplate writing across the bottom of the bronze frame, Joey, painted by Captain James Nichols, autumn 1914.
Only remembered, only remembered, only remembered for what we have done. These shall pass onward when we are forgotten. Only remembered for what we have done.
My earliest memories are a confusion of hilly fields and dark, damp stables. But I remember well enough the day of the horse sale. The terror of it stayed with me all my life. I was not yet 6 months old. A leggy colt would never be more than a few feet from his mother. We were parted that day in the terrible hubbub of the auction ring, and I was never to see her again. I was more difficult to dispose of. My buyer boasting.
That'll show you. Not bad for 3 guineas, is he?
The voice was harsh and thick with drink.
Not bad at all. Huh? Come on, you.
I was dragged along the lanes, tied on a short rope, so that every twist and turn wrenched at my neck. Eventually, we reached the farm that was to become my home. Two heads appeared at my stable door. One was that of a young boy, who looked at me for a long time before his face broke into a beaming smile.
Look at him, Mother. He's red almost. Red Bay you'd call him, wouldn't you? And that white cross down his nose is perfect. He'll be a wonderful and brave horse. There won't be an horse to touch him, not in the whole of Devon.
Albert was about the same height as me and talked so gently as he approached that I was immediately calm.
We'll get on, you and I. I shall call you Joey, because it suits you. And don't worry, I'll look after you. And that's a true promise.
You should never talk to horses, Albert. They never understand. You're the stupid creatures. That's what your father says, and he's had horses all his life.
Father doesn't understand them, Ma. I think they frighten him. And anyway, when Father's drunk, he don't know what he's saying or what he's doing, and he's always drunk on market days.
Hey, that's enough of that, my lad. Bed.
Yes, Ma. Sweet dreams, Joey.
I went over to the door and watched Albert and his mother walking into the darkness. I knew then I'd found a friend for life. Through the hard winters and hazy summers that followed, Albert and I grew up together. And when he called me, I was there.
Come on, you on, Joey, come on. Good boy. Yep.
We were now both strapping sons of the soil. As Albert made his true promise, it was he who cared for me and protected me all he could from his father. Albert's father was not a bad man, but when cider had been taken, his normal reticence deserted him, and a noisy waywardness set in until the sober light of day brought remorse and guilt. Market days and their consequences were a weekly problem for Albert and his mother. On one such autumn evening, about 2 years after I came to the farm, Albert was up in the village church ringing the bells. I must have been standing asleep when suddenly there was a light of a lantern at the stable door. I thought at first it might be Albert, but then I heard that unmistakable slurred Market Day voice.
So, my proud little devil, I've a bet on that I can have you ploughing inside a week. Farmer Easton and the others at the George think I can't handle you, but I'll show them. Now, we can do this the nice way or the nasty way. You give me trouble and I'll whip you till you bleed.
One look at the raised stick sent my heart thumping. Terrified, I knew I could not run, so I put my back to him and lashed out. I felt my hooves strike home. I heard a cry of pain and turned to see him crawling out of the stable, muttering cruel words of vengeance.
I'll show you, you beggar.
That next morning, Albert and his father came out together to the stables, and I could see that Albert had been crying, for his pale cheeks were stained with tears.
If your mother hadn't begged me last night, Albert, I'd have shot that horse on the spot. I'm warning you, if he's not ploughing straight as an arrow, inside a week he'll be sold. Sold! And that's a true promise.
When Albert came into the stable, it was not to soothe me, as he usually did.
That was devilish stupid last night, Joey. Now you listen here. You and me have got to learn to plough.
And so my training as a farm horse began. Albert was coaxing continuously whenever I hesitated or went offline.
Pull, Joey, pull! Straight, boys, straight! No, this way! Come on, you silly, pull! Calm, boy! Come on, Joey!
I lent my weight into the collar and began to pull. Every muscle I had ached. Each day, as I progressed, we began to plough as more of a team. Then, one afternoon, he unhitched the plough. He was quiet for a moment, and I thought I'd failed him. Then, suddenly, he threw his arms around my neck, shouting,
Joey, you've done it! They've been watching us from over yonder. Father's won his bet. You ploughed! You ploughed, Joey. He can't sell you now. Good boy, Joey. Good boy.
It was some months later that Albert first spoke to me about the war.
Mother says there's likely to be a war, Joe. I don't know what it's about. Something about some old duke that's been shot somewhere. Family falling out or something. But it won't bother us, Joe. Nah, we'll go on just the same.
One hot summer evening, after a long day in the fields, I was deep into my mash and oats when I heard his father's heavy footsteps coming across the yard.
Mother, come out! It's war, Mother! I just heard it in the village. We're at war with the Germans!
Two wars continued unabated. One in France, the other on the farm between Albert and his father, with Albert's mother caught in the crossfire. Albert's father left me alone these days, so when he came into the stable and held out a bucket of oats, I was immediately suspicious. But the sweet-smelling oats and my own inquisitiveness overcame my better judgment, and he was able to slip a halter over my neck before I could pull away. His voice was unusually gentle and kind as he tightened the halter and reached out slowly to stroke my neck. He walked me out of the stable, up the road, and into the village. There were men in khaki uniforms everywhere.
And the rough of the scarlet and the blue, with their helmets a-glittering in the sun. And the bayonets flash like lightning to the beating of a military drum. And of all will I go harvesting, or gathering the golden corn. For I took the good king's shilling, and I'm off tomorrow morn.
An officer pushed through the crowds towards us. He was tall and elegant in his joppers and Sam Brown belt, with a silver sword at his side. He shook Albert's father by the hand.
Told you I'd come. It's because I need the money, you understand. Wouldn't part with a horse like this unless I had to.
Well, I thought you'd be exaggerating when we talked in the George last night. Finest horse in the parish, you said, but then everyone says that. But this one is different, I can see that. I wouldn't mind using him myself.
£40, Captain Nichols, like you promised. I can't let him go for a penny less. Man's got to live.
Albert's father took the proffered notes from Captain Nichols, stuffing them quickly in his trouser pocket. He slipped into the crowd and was gone. It was then that I fully realised I was being abandoned, and I began to neigh, a high-pitched cry of pain and anxiety that shrieked out through the village. I had just given up hope when I saw my Albert running towards me through the crowd.
He's so many. Joey is my horse. He's my horse, and he always will be, no matter who buys him. If Joey goes with you, I go. I want to join up.
How old are you, young man?
16, sir. Well, 16 next, like.
You've the right spirit for a soldier. You've the spirit, but you haven't the years. 17's the youngest we take. Come back in a year or so and we'll see. What's your name, lad?
Narracott, sir. Albert Narracott.
Well, Albert, I'm sorry, I can't change things. But don't you worry about your Joey. I shall take good care of him until you're ready to join us. You've done a fine job on him. So when you're old enough, you must come and join the yeomanry. Mention my name, I'm Captain Nichols, and I'd be proud to have you with us. Your horse belongs in the army now.
Can I say goodbye to him, Captain Nichols, sir?
Of course you can, Albert.
Captain Nichols understood and left us to our privacy. Albert wriggled my nose for me, as he often did.
I'll find you again, you old silly. Wherever you are, I'll find you, Joey. And that's a true promise.
Sitting on an upturned bucket in the corner of my stable, Captain Nichols, sketchbook on his knees, spoke gently as his eyes flicked between me and the page.
I've done a few sketches of you now, and when I finish this one, I'll be ready to paint your picture. I'm going to send it off to your friend Albert, just so he'll know that I meant what I said when I promised to look after you.
A door banged across the yard, and I heard the familiar sound of boots. Corporal Samuel Perkins, a hard, gritty little man, an ex-jockey, whose only pleasure in life seemed to be the power he could exert over a horse.
Good evening, sir. Doing your drawings again?
Doing my best, Corporal. Doing my best to do him justice.
Oh, he's good-looking enough, sir, I grant you that. But looks aren't everything, are they, sir? There's always more to an horse than meets the eye. How shall I put it, sir?
However you like, Corporal, but be careful what you say, for that's my horse you're speaking about, so take care.
Let's say I feel he has a mind of his own. Never been properly schooled, sir, you can tell that. Farm horse he is, and farm trained.
I asked you to train Joey because you're the best man for the job. But keep it gentle. I don't want him soured. We leave for France in under a week now, and Corporal, I'd be obliged if you'd feed Joey up somewhat. He's lost a bit of condition. He's to look the best in the squadron.
Sir.
Corporal Perkins seemed less harsh after that evening. He used the spurs less and gave me more rein. By the time Captain Nichols came to take me out on those last manoeuvres before we went to war, I was quite resigned to my new life. Dressed now in field service marching order, Captain Nichols weighed heavy on my back as the entire regiment moved out on Salisbury Plain. The air was electric with anticipation. Captain Nichols was leading his troop, and alongside him rode his friend, Captain Jamie Stewart, on a horse I'd never seen before. A tall, shining black stallion. The walk moved into a trot, and then a canter. Captain Nichols leaned forward in the saddle and urged me into a gallop. I flew over the ground and way out ahead of the rest of them, except one, the giant black stallion. Although nothing was said, I felt it was suddenly important I should not allow this horse to get ahead of me. When we overran the pretend enemy, it was all our riders could do to bring us to a halt.
You see, Jamie, I told you so. This is the horse I was telling you about, found in deepest Devon. If we'd gone on much longer, your Topthorn would have been struggling to stay with him. You can't deny it.
My Topthorn is the finest in the regiment.
Topthorn and I looked warily at each other. He was huge and held his head with a majestic dignity. We were stabled beside each other that night. And again, on the boat the next day, we found ourselves together in the converted liner that was to carry us to France and to war. On the ship there was an air of great exuberance and expectancy, as if the soldiers were embarking on some great military picnic. But the moment we docked, the mood changed. The troopers fell silent and somber as we walked past unending lines of wounded, waiting to board the ship back to England. And etched on every man was the look of wretched misery and pain. No sergeant major, no enemy barrage, could have silenced the body of soldiers as effectively as that terrible sight. Here, for the first time, the men saw the kind of war they were going into. Captain Nichols and Captain Stewart were rarely apart. They seemed somehow separate in their spirit from their fellow officers. No one, it appeared, really knew where the enemy was. We scoured the countryside for days before finally blundering into them. And that was a day I shall never forget. The day of our first battle. The orders rang out.
Forward! Form squadron column! Draw swords! Squadron! Right shoulder!
We walked in line abreast into the wood. I felt Captain Nichols' knees close tight around me.
Easy, Joey. Easy now. We'll come out of this all right. Don't you worry.
I turned to look at Topthorn, moving closer to him. And as the bugle sounded, we charged out of the shade and into the sunlight of battle. I was aware of the glint of Captain Nichols' sword, his spurs in my side and his battle cry. I saw the grey soldiers ahead of us raise their rifles and heard the death rattle of a machine gun. Suddenly, I had no rider, and I was alone out in front of the squadron. With horses behind me, I knew there was only one way to go, and that was forward. Blind terror drove me on. I ran on until I was away from the noise of battle and would not have stopped at all had I not found Topthorn once more beside me and Captain Stewart leaning over to gather up my reins. Horses lay dead and dying everywhere. More than a quarter of the squadron had been lost in that one action. It had been so quick and so deadly. I never saw Captain Nichols again. And that was a great and terrible sadness for me. Topthorn stood over me that night. We looked out over the moonlit valley and I longed for home. I longed for Albert and his songs.
Round goes the wheel of fortune. Don't be afraid to ride. There's a land of milk and honey waits on the other side. There'll be peace and there'll be plenty. You'll never need to roam. When we go rolling home, when we go rolling home. Rolling home when we go rolling.
Next day, A nervous-looking young man came to the horse line.
Well, Trooper, here he is. Come closer. He won't bite. This is Joey. This horse belonged to the best friend I ever had, so you look after him, do you hear?
Yes, sir.
That's all, Warren. Carry on.
Sir.
Take care of him, Joey. He's only a young lad, and he's had a rough ride so far. Do it for Captain Nichols, eh, Joey?
Trooper Warren was not a good horseman, but once out of the saddle, he was the gentlest of men. He told me that during the same action that Captain Nichols had been killed, he had his horse shot from beneath him.
I tell you, Joey, never thought I'd get on an horse again. Not after that first battle. I'm over it now. You've done that for me. Give me back my confidence.
With the onset of winter, the rain came down in sheets. It was refreshing at first, but soon the fields and paths turned to mud beneath us. Trooper Warren looked after me with great devotion. He talked a great deal about how the war was going. The armies, it appeared, had pounded each other to a standstill in the mud and had dug in. During that awful winter, so many of the horses went off to veterinary hospital and never came back. Then, one icy cold night in early spring, with frost lying on our backs, the troopers came back to the horse lines unexpectedly early. It was before dawn. In the cold grey of night, the squadron joined the regiment in a little ruined village and waited until the pale light of dawn crept over the horizon. We passed the field hospitals and the light guns before trotting over the support trenches to catch our first sight of the battlefield. Desolation and destruction were everywhere. The trenches were crammed with men, their bayonets fixed to their rifles. They gave us a sporadic cheer as we clattered over the boards and out into no man's land, into a wilderness of barbed wire and the terrible litter of war.
Stand to me, bonny lads. Stand to and make you ready. Let bright bands rule the flame. This day shall bear your name. Stand to me, bonny lads. Hold the line right steady.
Suddenly, the gun stopped firing overhead. The bugle sounded and I felt the spurs biting into my sides and moved up alongside Topthorn as we broke into a trot.
Do me proud, Joey. Do me proud.
For just a few moments, we moved forward at a trot.
Wire! Oh, God, Joey! They said the wire had begun.
I stumbled once and felt him lose a stirrup and slowed so that he could find it again. Trooper Warren prayed aloud as he rode, but his prayers soon turned to curses as he saw the carnage around him. Some of the horses ran into the wire before they could be stopped and stuck there, their riders feverishly trying to extract them. I saw one trooper dismount deliberately once he saw his horse was caught. He pulled out his carbine and shot his mount before falling dead on the wire himself. The only way through was to jump the wire. When I saw Topthorn and Captain Stewart leap over where the wire was lowest, I followed them, and we found ourselves at last in amongst the enemy. I looked around for the rest of the squadron, only to discover that we were alone. Behind us, the riderless horses and the hillside were strewn with the dead and the dying.
Throw down your sword, Trooper. There's been enough useless slaughter today. No sense in adding to it.
He dismounted as the German soldiers closed in, and Trooper Warren followed suit. They stood side by side, holding our reins while we were surrounded. We looked back down the hill at the battlefield. A few horses were still struggling on the wire, but one by one, they were put out of their misery.
What a waste. What a ghastly waste. Maybe now they'll understand that you can't send horses into wire and machine guns. Maybe now they'll think again.
The horses, sir. Joey in top form. What happens to them now?
Same as us, trooper. We're all prisoners of war now.
Flanked by the soldiers, we were escorted over the brow of the hill and down into the valley below. Trooper Warren spoke softly into my ear.
Don't suppose they'll let you come with me where I'm going, Joey. I shan't ever forget you.
Don't you worry, trooper. The Germans love their horses every bit as much as we do.
There was no time for long farewells, just a brief last stroke of the muzzle for each of us, and they were gone. No one seemed to know quite what to do with us, until an officer in a long grey coat with a bandage round his head emerged from the tent. He looked us both over in undisguised admiration.
There are hundreds like these dead on our wire. These two horses came through hell fire to get here. They were the only two to make it. It was not their fault. They were sent on a fool's errand. They are not circus animals. They are heroes. Do you understand? Heroes. And they should be treated as such. You cannot put fine British cavalry horses to pulling carts. I will not permit it.
Herr Hauptmann, do you really imagine that after this morning's madness that either side will be using cavalry again? We need transport. There are men, brave German and English, lying out there on stretchers in the trenches. Now do you want them all to die, Herr Hauptmann?
The world has gone quite mad. But I can see that you are right. I am a lancer, Herr Doctor, but even I know that men are more important than horses. But you must see to it that you have someone in charge of these two that knows horses.
That same afternoon after our capture, Topthorne and I were hitched up side by side to an old hay cart. With the officer directing two orderlies, we were driven up through the woods back towards the thunder of the gunfire and the wounded that awaited us. Topthorne was in a great state of alarm, for it was clear he had never pulled before in his life. And at last, I was able in my turn to help him, to lead, to compensate, to reassure.
You have done this before, my friend. I can tell that.
It was almost night before the tall officer left us. The doctor turned to the orderlies who had been with us all day.
See to it that they are well cared for, these two. They saved good lives today. They deserve the best of care.
After we had finished our hay, Topthorne and I were lying down together at the back of the shed. Suddenly, the door creaked open, and the stable filled with a flickering orange light. Behind the light, there were footsteps. We looked up, and I was seized at that moment with a kind of panic, reminding me at once of Albert's father. However, when the voice spoke, it was not the rasping, drunken voice of market days in Devon, but rather the soft, gentle tone of a child. I could see now that there were two people behind the light, a bent old man in rough clothes and clogs, and beside him, a young girl, her head and shoulders wrapped in a shawl.
There you are, Grandfather. I told you they had put them in here. Oh, have you ever seen anything so beautiful? Oh, can they be mine? Grandfather, please, please, can they be mine?
Next morning, we made it to the front line through heavy snow. The field dressing station behind the front line was crowded with wounded. Someone suddenly remembered it was Christmas Day, and they sang a slow, tuneful carol all the way back. For the most part, they were casualties blinded by gas, and in their pain, some of them cried as they sang. It was already a starry night, and by the time we reached the farm, the shelling had stopped. There were no flares to light up the sky and blot out the stars. Not a gun fired. Peace had come for one night. One at least. And all was to stay well for a time at least. For the war suddenly moved away from us, and we were needed less and less to pull our ambulance cart back and forth through the trenches. Topthorne and I were put out to grass, and our Emily would always come to get us before dark. One evening, we were out in the meadow, and we heard the sound of an approaching convoy. Suddenly, Emily was running over to us, shouting and screaming.
I knew it. I prayed for it to happen. They don't need you anymore. The doctor has told Grandfather that you can both stay. He says you can stay and work on the farm.
For Topthorne, the transition from pulling an ambulance cart to pulling a hay turner was not a difficult one, and he adapted easily. And for me, it was a dream I had dreamed many times since I left the farm in Devon.
I will garland a bonnet of daisies to crown you the Queen of May, and all will behold the seasons unfold. As surely as night follows day, loud and soul,
the hay was almost gathered in, when one evening, soldiers came to our farm. Their faces were strange and harsh. There was a new alarm and urgency in their eyes.
Grandfather doesn't like them here. He doesn't trust the officer. Says he's got eyes like a wasp, and you can't trust a wasp. But they will be gone in the morning, and then we'll be on our own again.
By full light, the artillery troop was drawn up in the yard and ready to move. There was a loud and incessant knocking on the farmhouse door, and we saw Emily and her grandfather come out still dressed in their nightclothes.
Your horses, monsieur. I shall be taking your horses.
But how can I work my farm without horses?
There's a war, and I must have horses for my guns. The army needs them.
Oh, no, but you can't. They are my horses. Grandfather, please don't let them. Please, please don't let them know. No.
We were back among the fearful noise and stench of battle, urged on and sometimes whipped by men who displayed little care or interest in our welfare. Food was scarcer now. Our corn rations were spasmodic and hay was in meagre supply. I first noticed that Topthorne was failing when I felt the gun pulling more heavily than before. His eyes told me the pain he was suffering, and I pulled all the harder to enable him to ease up. That night I stood over him as he lay down in the mud. He lay stretched out on his side, lifting his head from time to time as the spasms of coughing shook him. I consoled myself with the thought that no horse I'd ever seen had the stamina and power of Topthorne. And sure enough, he was up on his feet the next morning, although his head hung lower than usual and he moved only ponderously. So Topthorne came into that spring weakened severely by his illness, but he had survived. We had both survived. There were to be no battles for us that summer. We grazed the lush buttercup meadows and we even became fat for the first time since we came to war. Perhaps it was because we became too fat that Topthorne and I were chosen to pull the ammunition cart from the railhead some miles away up to the artillery lines, and so found ourselves under the command of a kind old soldier everyone called Mad Friedrich.
I tell you, my friends, I tell you, I am the only sane one in the regiment. It is the others that are mad. They fight a war, and they do not know what it is for. That is crazy, yes? And it is me they call mad.
As the weeks went by, it became apparent that Friedrich took a particular liking to Topthorne. The summer passed slowly into autumn. Such was Friedrich's attachment to Topthorne that he volunteered to ride him out on the gun team. And so we found ourselves the leading pair once again, with mad old Friedrich riding up on Topthorne. We had found at last one true friend, and one we could trust implicitly. The gun troop was resting at midday under the welcome shade of a large chestnut glade that covered both banks of a silver glinting river. Friedrich led us down to the river to drink. Topthorn lowered his head into the water beside me and shook it vigorously as he usually did, showering me all over my face and neck and bringing me sweet relief from the heat. The hill back up into the woods was steep and rutty, so it was no surprise that Topthorn stumbled once or twice, but he regained his balance each time and plodded on beside me up the hill. His breathing was suddenly short and rasping. Then, as we neared the shade of the trees, Topthorn stumbled to his knees. He lay where he had fallen, breathing heavily, and lifted his head once to look at me. It was an appeal for help. I could see it in his eyes. I bent down to nuzzle him, pushing at his neck in a frantic effort to make him move, to make him wake up, but I knew instinctively he was already dead, that I had lost my best and dearest friend. Friedrich was down on his knees beside him.
9999. Oh, my friend. He's dead. For God's sake, he's dead. Why does this war have to destroy everything that is fine and beautiful? We should not treat horses like this. We treat our machines better. We are such fools.
The soldiers gathered around us in complete silence in a moment of spontaneous respect and sadness. As we stood on that hillside, I heard the first whistle of a shell above us and saw the first explosion as it landed in the river. Suddenly, the wood was alive with shouting, rushing soldiers, and the shells were falling around us everywhere. My first inclination was to run anywhere to escape the shelling, but Topthorn lay dead at my feet, and I would not abandon him. Friedrich tried all he could to drag me away up behind the shoulder of the hill, shouting and screaming at me to come if I wanted to live. But no man can move a horse that does not want to be moved, and I did not want to go. As the shelling intensified, he threw down my reins and tried to make his escape. But it was too slow, and he left it too late. He never reached the woods. He was struck down only a few paces from Topthorn, rolled back down the hill and lay beside him, his arm around Topthorn's neck in a final embrace. I stood by Topthorn and Friedrich all that day and into night. The shelling moved back and forth along the valley, showering grass, earth and trees into the air, and leaving behind craters as smoked as if the earth itself was on fire. It was near first light when I heard the whining sound of motors, accompanied by a terrifying rattle of steel that set my ears back against my head. Although at the time I did not know it as such, the first tank I ever saw came over the rise of the hill with the cold light of dawn behind it. I ran, I know not where. I remember crossing the river again, through empty farmyards and clattering through deserted, ruined villages before I found myself in a lush, wet meadow. I had made my mind to stay where I was. When there was an explosion of white light above my head and the rattle of a machine gun split the night air, I ran again and kept running into the night. Wherever I went now, there was great craters in the ground filled with murky, stagnant water. It was as I staggered out of one such crater that I lumbered into an invisible coil of barbed wire that first snagged and trapped my foreleg. As I kicked out wildly to free myself, I felt the barbs tearing into my flesh before I broke clear. From then on, I could only manage to limp on slowly into the night, mile after terrifying mile. My wounded leg was stiffening up all the time, and it pained me now even to lift it. Very soon, I found I could put no weight on it at all. Dawn was creeping in, when I heard the sound of hushed, urgent voices muffled in the mist.
Sarge, there it is again. Look, something moving in the mist.
What was it then, son? The whole ruddy German army or just one or two of them out for an early morning stroll?
That's no man, Sarge. Mind you, could be an horse or a cow.
An horse or a cow? Out there in no man's land? You've been at General Egg's whiskey, son. Your eyes is playing tricks on you.
I saw it an all, Sarge. Honest, cross me out.
Well, I can't see nothing. And if I can't see nothing, son, that's because there's nothing there.
As he spoke, I limped away. And as I did, I felt the first of the day's sunlight. Within minutes, the mist began to clear, and I saw for the first time I was standing in a wide corridor of mud. A wasted, shattered landscape between two vast, unending rows of barbed wire that stretched way into the distance. From both sides of me, I heard a gradual crescendo of excitement and laughter rippling along the trenches, interspersed with barked orders that everyone was to keep their heads down and no one was to shoot. I was drawn first one way and then the other, but each time I neared the trenches on either side, I met an impenetrable barrier of barbed wire. Then out of the corner of my eye, I saw a small man in a grey uniform clamber up out of the trenches, waving a white flag above his head. He began to clip his way methodically through the wire and then pull it aside. Then from the other side, a helmeted figure in a khaki greatcoat climbed up. He too held up a flag of truce and also began to walk his way through the wire towards me. It was the German who was through the wire first. He approached slowly,
come and see you, Peter.
Calling out to me all the time to come towards him, when suddenly,
aye,
a shout came from behind me.
All right, lad.
I turned to see a giant khaki man blustering his way across no man's land.
You're going the wrong way, pal.
For a few strange, silent moments, the two men stood yards apart from each other. It was the giant in khaki who broke the silence.
Morning. Now what do we do? There's two of us here, and one horse to split between us.
Both armies looked on in total silence as the two men attempted to communicate.
You know horses? He's bad. He's wounded leg. Broken, you think?
The giant bent over and lifted my leg gently and expertly, wiping the mud from around the wound.
He's in a mess, right enough. But I don't think it's broken, Jerry. It's a bad wound, though. Gotta get him seen too quick. Question is, who takes him?
After a moment's stalemate, the German dug deep into his pocket and produced a coin.
You choose. Head or tail, I think you say, yeah? I will show it, the coin, to everyone. And everyone will know who wins the horse is only by chance. No one loses any pride. And everyone will be happy.
Happy? All right, then. Go ahead, Jerry. You toss. I'll call.
The German tossed the coin, spinning it high into the air. As it fell to ground, a single voice rang out across the wasteland.
Heads.
The two mighty armies held their breaths as their champions looked at each other in a vacuum of rare silence. Then...
That is the face of my Kaiser looking up at me out of the mud. And he does not look too pleased. So I'm afraid, Tommy... You have won. The horse is yours.
He held out his hand in a gesture of friendship and reconciliation. Without hesitation, the two men clasped hands momentarily. And in that moment, they were friends.
In 1 hour or so, we will be trying to kill each other again. Take care, Tommy, my friend.
Same to you, mate. Keep your head down.
Wiedersehen.
And you, pal. Come on, you. Let's get you home.
Thanks to the gentle giant, I arrived at the veterinary hospital where I was greeted by a chorus of excited neighing. Over every stable door, there were heads of inquisitive horses, ears pricked. There were men in khaki everywhere. I found myself the centre of anxious and admiring attention in the middle of the courtyard.
What in thunder do you think you lot are about? It's an horse, just like the others. It may be a famous horse. It may be the only thundering horse in the old thundering war brought in alive from no man's land. But this is the scruffiest, dirtiest, muddiest horse I've ever seen. He's a thundering disgrace. You blighters can get back to your work. Head the double. Not you, Narracott. Major Martin will be down in 10 minutes to examine that horse. And I want him so thundering clean and thundering shiny, you could use him as a shaving mirror. Right?
Yes, Sergeant.
It was a reply that sent a sudden shiver through me. He took hold of my halter.
I swear there's not an inch of you that's not covered in mud or worse. Job to tell what you look like under all that mess. Still, we'll soon see.
And the way he whistled as he cleaned up his brushes was the whistle that went with the voice I knew. It confirmed my rising hopes, and I knew then that I could not be mistaken. In my overwhelming delight, I reared up and cried out to him to recognise me.
Hey! Careful there, you silly. Nearly had me hat off.
You're talking to them horses again, Albert. God, Struve. Won't you never give up? They say there's nearly 500,000 ruddy horses out here, and you join the vet corps just to find one of them.
You'll understand why when you see him, David. He's a bright red bay with a black mane and tail. He has a white cross on his forehead and four white socks that are all even to the last inch. He's perfect, from head to tail.
Well, this one's got white socks on his front legs anyway. That's as far as I can tell. So we're halfway there.
The two men worked tirelessly on me, scraping and brushing and washing.
Three. That's three white socks.
Turn it up, David. I know what you think. I know everyone thinks I'll never find him.
Four. That's four legs and four white socks. Only the cross on the forehead now and you'll have your Joey standing here.
David was standing now by my head. He lifted my mane and brushed gently at my forehead, blowing the dust away from my eyes.
Albert, I'm not teasing, mate. Honest, I'm not. You said your Joey had four white socks, all even to the inch, right? And you said Joey had a white cross on his forehead? Well, no messing. This horse has four white, evenly marked socks and a clear white cross on his head.
As David was speaking, Albert suddenly dropped my tail and moved slowly around me, running his hand along my back.
Joey? Joey? It could be. But there's one way I know to be sure.
He untied my rope and walked away before facing me, cupping his hands to his lips. Suddenly, there was no pain in my leg, and I trotted over to him and buried my nose in his shoulder.
It's him! It really is! It's my Joey! I found him! I found him, Joey! Oh, Joey, boy, it's you! There you are, good boy!
And there will come a time of great plenty.
Oh, Joey!
A time of good harvest and song. Till then, put your trust in tomorrow, my friend. For yesterday's over and done, and the snow falls, and the wind calls, and the year turns round again.
When the end of the war did come, it came swiftly, almost unexpectedly. It was little joy, little celebration of victory, only a profound relief that at last it was finished and done with.
5 minutes' time and it'll all be finished, Joey. All over and we can both go back home. At 11 o'clock, the guns will stop and then that will be that.
The bell in the clock tower rang out 11 times. And the men shook each other solemnly by the hand, or clapped each other on the back before returning to their duties. Apart from the newfound calm, our daily routine was unchanged. Until one dreary, drizzling morning, Major Martin did not inspect the stables as usual. Sergeant Thunder stood the men at ease, and the Major announced the re-embarkation plans.
So! We shall be at Victoria Station by 6 o'clock on Saturday morning. And with any luck, you'll be home by Christmas.
Mission to speak, sir. It's about the horses, sir. I think the men would like to know what's going to happen with the horses.
The horses will be staying in France.
Sir, but how can they?
All the horses here are either sick or have been sick. It's not considered worthwhile to transport them back home. My orders are to hold a horse sale here in this courtyard tomorrow afternoon.
Worthwhile, sir? Our horses are to be put under the hammer after all they've been through. You know what will happen.
Yes, Sergeant, I know what will happen to them. We're in the army, Sergeant, and I don't have to remind you that orders are orders.
But you know what they'll go for. There's thousands of our horses here in France. War veterans they are. Do you mean to say after all they've been through? I can't believe they mean it, sir.
There was an air of determined conspiracy abroad. That evening, their voices low and earnest. The men were still talking, but now Sergeant Thunder was with them. He carried a small tin box, which was being passed from one to the other. And they heard the clink of coins as they were dropped in.
That's the best we can do, lads. It's not a lot, but then we haven't got a lot, have we?
Have you got enough, Sarge?
I'm hoping so, son, I'm hoping so.
By the time the first buyers arrived, I was fed and watered, and groomed so hard that my winter coat gleamed red as I was led out into the morning sun. Albert walked me around in a tight circle, bringing me to a standstill, facing a line of red, craggy faces and greedy, grasping eyes. Then, I noticed amongst the buyers the still, strong figure of Sergeant Thunder, and to one side, the entire veterinary unit watching the proceedings anxiously. The bidding began. I was clearly much in demand, and as the price rose swiftly, there seemed to be only two bidders left. One of them, the sergeant.
At 25. 26. Sergeant Thunder's bid. At £26. At 27. 27 I'm bid. Any more, please?
Oh, God, no. Dear God, not him.
It's against the sergeant there. At 27. Any more, please?
It's one of them, Joey. He's been buying all morning.
Selling them for 27.
Sergeant Thunder says he's the butcher from Cambrai.
Going.
Please, God, no.
Going.
28. I'm bidding you 28 of your English pounds. And I'll bid for so long and so high as I need to. For this horse, I will beat all of your bids.
Even the auctioneer was stunned into silence. And there was a moment of delay before he brought his hammer down, and I was sold. A look of resigned dejection descended on Sergeant Thunder's face. He and Major Martin spoke together with my buyer, a shabbily dressed old man. The yard was empty of horses now. Holding on to Sergeant Thunder's arm, the old man crossed the yard to Albert.
So, it was you that trained the horse to be a farm horse? You did well, my son. Very well. Your horse and I are old friends. He came to live with us. There was with him another great, shining black horse. My little granddaughter, Emily, cared for them and came to love them like her own family. But they were taken from us. There was nothing we could do. After that, my Emily lost the will to live. She just faded away and died last year. She was just 15. Tommy, your major and your sergeant have told me how much you love this horse and how every one of these men tried so hard to buy him. I think that is a noble thing. I think my Emily would have liked that. I think she would want me to do what I will do now. I will sell my Emily's horse to you.
Sell? How can I afford to buy him?
You don't understand, my friend. I will sell you this horse for one English penny and for a solemn promise that you will always love this horse as much as my Emily did, and you will care for him until the end of his days. I want you to tell everyone about my Emily. That way, she will live forever. That is what I want. Is it a bargain between us?
Albert said nothing. He simply held his hand out in acceptance. But the old man ignored it. put his hand on Albert's shoulders and kissed him on both cheeks.
Thank you.
He hobbled back and stood in front of me.
Goodbye, my friend.
And touched me lightly on the nose with his lips.
From Emily.
He had only gone a few paces before he stopped and turned around.
Then it is true. There is only one thing at which the English are better than the French. They are meaner. You have not paid me my English penny.
Sergeant Thunder hastily produced a penny from his tin and gave it to Albert.
Here, go on, me son.
I shall treasure it, Tommy. I shall treasure it always.
And so I came back from the war that Christmas time, with my Albert riding me up into the village to the rapturous pealing of the church bells. Both of us were received like conquering heroes, but we both knew that the real heroes had not come home, that they were lying out in France alongside Captain Nichols, Topthorne, Friedrich, and little Emily.
The painting of Joey still hangs in the village hall. Only a very few now, and fewer as each year goes by, remember him. His story is written so that neither he, nor those who knew him, nor the war they lived and died in, will be forgotten.
Who'll sing the anthems and who'll tell the story? Will the light hold? Will it scatter and run? Shall we at last be united in glory? Only remembered for what we have done. Only remembered, only remembered, only remembered for what we have done. Shall we at last be united in glory? Only remembered for what we have done. Only remembered for what we have done.
In Michael Morpurgo's Warhorse, Timothy Spall was the voice of Joey. Also appearing were Brenda Bleffin, Bob Hoskins, Ben Adams, David Beams, Jasper Britton, Gorn Granger, Jeffrey Hughes, Jack Leonard, Paul Slack, Luke Treadaway, and Angus Wright. The music was performed by Coop, Boyce and Simpson, John McCusker, Andy Cutting, and Andy Seward. The director was John Tams, and the producer was John Leonard. Warhorse was a Smooth Operations production for BBC Radio 2.